Constitution, demanding the rights of we the people, broadcasting the truth, the Puppet Media Dare Not Report. Long live liberty and death to the New World Order. Prepare yourself. This is the Alternative Media.
And hello, everybody. Welcome to the Alternative Media. I'm Patrick Slattery, and Farron is, your regular host. He is still on his leave of absence. He'll be back sooner or later. But in the meantime, I'm going to have fun with his show. And today is going to be a great show. We have with us online, as I speak, we have Professor Kevin McDonald, a psychology professor from California State University at Long Beach. He is the person who, more than anyone else in academia, has really studied Jewish psychology, Judaism as an evolutionary strategy, and he is really the foremost authority on so many issues regarding the Jewish role in our society. Professor McDonald, welcome to the show.
Hi, Patrick. It's good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. You know, I want to start off, a lot of people are familiar with you, but I want, briefly, but I want to go over your body of work so that, you know, we have kind of a theoretical basis for where we go when we talk about what's the implications of this Jewish power is for our present and our future, how relevant it all is. You've written a trilogy of books on Jews and Judaism, A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy. That was the first one that dealt with Judaism. Separation and Its Discontents Toward an Evolutionary Theory of Antisemitism. That's your second book. And that deals with anti-Semitism, a response to Judaism. And then your last book, The Culture of Critique, An Evolutionary Analysis of Jewish Involvement in 20th Century Intellectual Movements. And so that's really kind of the implications of, you know, what that means for today. Could you just, in a nutshell, talk about the first book first, The A People That Shall Dwell Alone?
Well, the first book is really rather almost standard evolutionary thinking about humans. You know, I my background is in evolutionary psychology, and I began to study groups and think about groups from an evolutionary perspective, you know, what evolved out of that was a book on Jews, because I figured that the Jews were the most obviously interesting group to study, the best documented and everything. And so basically what that book is a series of chapters that talk about traditional Judaism, really. Traditional, it's more set in the you know, pre-20th century past. Not much of it is 20th century at all. It has to do with what Judaism was like traditionally in European societies, but also in the Muslim world, in the Middle East, and so on. And you know, basically, it's how these Jewish groups got on in the world. How did they conduct themselves? What sorts of tensions were there? But it, you know, was there resource competition? Were Jews in competition with other groups? Within Jewish groups, was there a strong emphasis on group identity, a strong emphasis on generosity within the group, strong emphasis really on ethnic networking, and so on. So that every chapter deals with a different aspect of that. The second chapter deals with Jewish population genetics as it was in 1994. It's changed a lot now, but the basic conclusions are still the same, that Jews are form a biologically connected group. They share genes with one another, and they are identifiable, you know, from a genetic point of view, and that continues to be the case. the third chapter is on the Old Testament. I mean, just reading the Old Testament, I'd never done that before. Being a Catholic and all that, I never read it before, and it was really remarkable to see the incredibly intense ethnocentrism in the Old Testament, incredible concern about marriage outside the group, the purity of the gene pool, and so on. It's really amazing. I mean, if you look at the Old Testament, it doesn't have anything really of a sort of religious aura at all, which I think you could say about the New Testament, but certainly you can't say it about the Old Testament. It's straight strategizing.
Right. I mean, there's very little about, for instance, an afterlife, or, and to the extent God plays a role in it, after the book of Genesis, to the extent he plays a role, it's kind of as just a personal or group, a protector for the Jewish people, but the Jewish people take the center stage throughout.
I even make the argument in the chapter on the Old Testament that what God really is in the Old Testament is the Jewish gene pool. That's what mm-hmm. God is. And so you have a set of laws that God gives, and what the laws are is basically how this gene pool is going to be preserved in a diaspora environment. And if there's any straying from the laws, bad things will happen. So throughout Jewish history, they've always explained anything that bad that happens, like some kind of anti-Jewish outburst. They explain that because they have not been true to God's law as defined in the Old Testament and the Talmud. That's how they think of it. So, I mean, God is nothing more than the pure Jewish gene pool. It's amazing.
Well, that's a fascinating comment. And of course, 3,000 years ago, when the Old Testament was being written, they had no idea what genes were or gene pool. Yet, the fact that the Jews have been so successful. You could have written this book about Amish or our Amish people. They haven't been around that long. But right. The fact that there has been a group around so long with such continuity. I mean, where else is there a group that has such continuity that has been so successful? And whether or not they realized that, they were worshiping their gene pool or their religion was based to protect and promote their gene pool, the fact that it actually was, in retrospect, explains a great deal.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing.
And just to, I want to ask you more questions about your books, but I just recently finished reading a literature review of genetic studies of the Jewish ethnic group, and there are studies that have been done on the Spanish Jews, the Sephardic Jews, or the Ashkenazi Jews, or the Jews of Yemen, or the Jews of the Middle East, and what you'll see in study after study, in population after population, is if they're looking at, for instance, the mitochondrial DNA, the DNA that gets handed down from mother to child, that the founder populations of these groups, they'll say that 50% or 60% of the this mitochondrial DNA came from two or three, or in one case, even one single woman. So it's amazing how one single woman with origins in the Middle East. So it's amazing how the diaspora, these small numbers of people left the Middle East and were able to protect that gene pool and procreate in such a way.
Right. There's certainly been some penetration of Jewish gene pool, but you can't have that kind of genetic commonality that you're referring to, where you look at Sephardic Jews, Ashkenazi Jews, Middle Eastern Jews, and so on, and you see that this genetic commonality, that can't happen unless this group is regulating gene flow.
Yeah, and actually, I misspoke a little bit. In the Y chromosomes, which are handed from father to son, you would have that, small number, often just a very small number in the founding population. With the mitochondrial DNA and the founding population being Semitic in origin, with the mitochondrial DNA, they weren't those small number of founding women weren't always Semitic in origin. Some of them were European in origin. But from that small founding population, very small founding populations, you've had this massive increase, and it shows that although the founding population might have been a little bit of admixture in the early population, over the many many centuries intervening, they've protected that gene pool, and there's been remarkably little exchange. And then your second book, which is on separation, is discontent toward an evolutionary theory of anti-Semitism. So this is the response of the host populations to Jewish behavior. Is that correct?
That's right. And you could see anti-Jewish attitudes and behavior really have a very long history going back to the ancient world. And, of course, from the Jewish point of view, they explain it because Jews themselves have violated God's law. In more modern times, they explain it as some kind of irrational non-Jewish hostility towards Jews. I mean, they have all these psychoanalytic theories, the Frankfurt School. They all had their theories, but there was no case where they really blamed Jewish behavior, and that's what I show. I mean, I think I show that all the major incidents of anti-Jewish outbursts in history, the major ones, have been motivated by a sense at the root is really resource competition and some kind of major conflict of interest. The Jews, for example, have often been sort of middlemen between the aristocracy and the common people. They would be moneylenders and do other things that would get the hostility of the common people going. You could see that in the Muslim world. You could see that in Christian Europe. You could see that in the ancient world, in the ancient Greek world, the ancient Roman world, early Christianity. In fact, my chapter on Christianity is something I always wish people would talk about more, because my view is that the early Christian church in the 4th century, not really early Christianity, but in the 4th century, became an anti-Jewish movement. And it was organized as an anti-Jewish movement, and it organized the exclusion of Jews from, say, government jobs, from prevented Jews from owning Christian slaves and so on, because Jews were becoming a dominant economic elite at that time, and that's really what was going on then, and the Christian church, as it developed in the Roman Empire, was really an institution that was geared towards combating this and protecting Christians from this onslaught. And it had quite an effect during the early centuries, and then sort of a checkered history after that. But the Catholic Church, if you look at the original church doctrines that really were written and kept in the books until, really until Vatican II, around 1960, they had very negative attitudes about Jews. They had very, very sort of realistic attitudes about anti-Semitism. And it's an amazing story, really.
So, to an extent, Christianity developed as a response to Jewish, what would you call it, cultural aggression or economic?
Yeah, I'd call it Jewish aggression, Jewish exploitation, Jewish enslavement of Christians. And what happened, if you look at Christian theology, especially as was originally thought of, I mean, the greatest sin of the Jews was killing Christ. I mean, that was the ultimate theological thing, and they rejected this new covenant, and they stayed true to their ways and did not embrace this new covenant. This was the theology, within this theology, the Jews had killed Christ. It says that very clearly, and of course, that's been sort of expunged now. You can't say that anymore, and the Catholic Church is officially repudiated because of Jewish pressure, really. But that was the theology for about 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm. And so those two books, they cover, you say, more than 2,000 years, if you're talking about the Old Testament, more like 3,000 years of Jewish history. But the third book in the trilogy, The Culture of Critique, that really explicitly looks at the 20th century, and it looks largely at academia, and then also the implications for the policy realm.
Right. The exceptions to the, as you say, most of it is are these intellectual movements, but chapter 3 is about Jews and the left, and so that gets into Jews' involvement in the political movements of the left. And chapter 7 is on Jews and immigration policy, and that, you know, that's a critical thing. I mean, as I say in that chapter, that this is the most basic issue of any society. Who are you going to allow into the society? Well, Jews were active and actually were the critical factor. I think I showed that, and I'm not the only one. They were a critical factor in changing American immigration policy. And they've had the same stance around the world, where if you go to Australia, you go to England, France, wherever, in Europe, Jews everywhere in the Western world have advocated, have advocated non-white immigration, and they're the ones that are really behind the idea that if you don't welcome all this immigration, you are a racist, you're an evil person, and we shouldn't even have to talk to you, and we should be changing these societies to make them welcome all the peoples of the world. That was really a Jewish project.
Mm-hmm. And what's common to all of these is you talk about Jewish ethnocentrism. And now, I know that your books deal a great deal with culture. But of course, evolution, when you talk about evolution, the term was originally applied to biology, to genetics. And there is a genetic aspect, and of course, culture, cultural evolution and genetic, biological evolution can impact each other. And there have been studies. There's a Jewish biologist at Stanford named Robert Sapolsky, and he's done studies on mice and demonstrated that mice can't, from the smell of each other's urine, they can tell kin groups from non-kin groups, and they can even they tend to favor areas that are inhabited by their kin, going to say third and fourth cousin, going that far out. And so just genetically, innately, instinctively, they can recognize their biological kin from non-kin. And, there have been studies of primates that have shown the same thing. And so certainly, without culture, just with genetics, the idea of ethnocentrism being passed on through the genes is possible. Now, with Jewish ethnocentrism, there could be that genetic component to it as well. There's certainly a big cultural component. And one thing that I think is critical in the Jewish ability to dominate our society in the 20th century is this asymmetry in recognition of the in-group and asymmetry in definition of the in-group, where most Jews can identify other Jews and non-Jews are not able to. I hear some music coming up, so I think we're coming up on our first break, but we'll be back after the break with Professor Kevin McDonald. We are back. This is the Alternative Media. I am Patrick Slattery, and I'm here with Professor Kevin McDonald. So, Professor McDonald, regarding ethnocentrism, do Jews have, are they more ethnocentric than other groups? And if so, is this cultural? Is it biological? Is it some combination of the two?
Well, typically we have to include both culture and biology in just about anything. But in my view, Jews are more ethnocentric. One of the things that really angered some of my colleagues at California State University was I said in the first book, People That Shall Dwell Alone, I said Jews were hyper ethnocentric. And I gave some reasons, you know, it's like a section of the last chapter, I believe. And boy, that really angered them. But the reality is, and I've expanded on this, I mean, if you were Jewish and you weren't very ethnocentric, say you wanted to marry somebody outside the group, say you weren't really on page with going to synagogue or helping out your fellows, or just weren't really on page with everyone else, you would be discarded. You know, you would not be part of the group anymore. And so there's natural selection over the centuries for Jews who were more ethnocentric. And so I think there was an actual genetic process there. If you think about it, your Jews do come from the Middle East, which is the most ethnocentric part of the world. We're seeing
so that. They start off with an ethnocentric gene stock.
Pardon?
In the first place, right? They start off with an ethnocentric gene stock.
Yeah, they start off on the ethnocentric end of things, and then they continue to hone that over the centuries. Again, Jews that weren't really on board with it would be cast aside. If they married somebody else, they'd be excluded. If they didn't pay their taxes, or if they ratted on another Jew or something like that, they would be thrown out, basically. But they come from the Middle East, which is ethnocentrism central. I mean, and we're seeing that now with these immigrants in Europe and America, these Muslim immigrants. I mean, they are fanatically ethnocentric. I mean, they're group-oriented, where they just these authoritarian groups that they gravitate to. And if you think about traditional Jewish groups, they were extremely authoritarian. They still are. If you go to Orthodox Jewish groups, you've got the rabbi, you ruled them with an iron hand. And if you dissented in some way, if you did anything that he didn't like or against the laws, boy, you were punished or ostracized. I mean, even now, you know, there's been a lot of sexual abuse in the Orthodox communities in New York. Well,
and elsewhere, in London, all sorts of places.
That's pretty common.
Yes.
You don't see much in the newspapers. But if a Jew were to go to the police or go to the media or something, there would be a huge, you know, campaign against his family. And that guy, that person would be ostracized. He'd have no future in the Jewish community. It's a very long tradition. And every once in a while in the newspaper, you see these Orthodox communities, they're involved in some kind of fraud. They're a tax fraud or some kind of land fraud or, you know, defrauding the school system or some government agency or whatever. They're almost like organized criminal enterprises. But if anybody within that group were to rat out to the authorities or something like that, they would have huge consequences. They could never show their face in the community again. They would be ostracized. Their whole and it wouldn't just be the person who did it. It'd be the whole family. You know, so that's the kind of, you know, if a Jew, you know, married a non-Jew, a traditional society, not only would that Jew be ostracized from the group, his whole family would have a black mark on it. And people would not want to marry into that family. It was always done, you know, with the kin group. And you see that in Israel now, where if a Palestinian, stabs an Israeli or something like that, his whole family will suffer. It's not just him. They go to the kin group, you know, and it's an instinctive reaction because these people are very kin oriented. They understand how genetic works at an intuitive level. If not a formal, probably these days they understand it at a formal level, but that's the weapon to use. If you want to really, you know, terrorize people in the Middle East or elsewhere, you go after their kin group.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had the experience of, I used to live in a Jewish neighborhood, and there was a pedophile who was going around, and it was a Jewish neighborhood, and so he was harassing the women, the little girls coming out of the Hillel Elementary School, and he was accosting kids on the public school bus. He had been lurking in my backyard. I got involved that way, and I started talking to everybody in the neighborhood, and I found out from one of my neighbors that, you know, he'd been climbing on roofs. He even intruded into the house of the rabbi and went into the rabbi's daughter's room, the rabbi would not call the police because this was a Jewish individual who was doing it, and Jews don't call, get the goyim involved in a matter with between Jews.
Yeah. I told you, there's a lot of examples. If you go to the website of the Oxford Observer and you type in a search box, the word spelled M-E-S-I-R-A-H, Mesira, something like that, you'll get quite a few articles on this Jewish code of honor where you do not rat on people.
Yeah. Okay. And then in your book, The Culture of Critique, you talk about these intellectual and political movements. You have the Boas School of Anthropology, the psychoanalytic movement, that's Freud, that's psychology, the Frankfurt School of Social Research, that would be sociology, and Jewish domination of these schools. And then also, even though you don't get into it and they're not necessarily left-wing movements, I mean, you think about the domination of economics by Jews, a variety of schools, like monetarism, which was Friedman. Well, we're coming up on another break. We'll be back after the break with Professor Kevin MacDonald.
Podcasting.org.
And welcome back to the Alternative Media. I'm Patrick Slattery. I am here with Professor Kevin MacDonald. So just before the break, Professor MacDonald, we were talking about the Jewish-led intellectual and political movements that appeared in U.S. universities in the 20th century. But the implications of this takeover of anthropology, psychology, sociology departments wasn't limited to the ivory tower, was it? What were the implications for a broader society? Professor MacDonald?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, yes. So what were the implications for a broader society?
It had huge implications beyond the academic world because Our society really runs in a sort of top-down manner. You have the academic world, and within the academic world, you have these very top-level institutions like Harvard and Yale, the Ivy Leagues, and so on. And then you've got the media and so on. So, but once these Jewish intellectual movements had a big toehold, or really eventually a sort of grip on the sort of high-level academic institutions, they had a very large effect on society, especially because the media was cooperating with them. I mean, psychoanalysis is a good example. This is a theory that had absolutely no empirical, support at all. But it was greeted as absolutely wonderful. It was run, the psychoanalysis was run sort of like a Gestapo or the secret police in Russia or something like that, where you have show trials. You're very much like the sort of Russian communist show trials where people would be expelled if they had deviant thoughts, if they didn't believe in the Oedipal complex and so on. It was run very much like a sort of organized cell. And if you deviated, you were simply thrown out. And so there was no research done. This was a theory that was respectable for at least 70, 80 years. Even now you can find people in universities, especially now, it's not so much. You almost don't see anybody in departments of psychology anymore, and even departments of psychiatry. But you do see it in departments of literature. You see it there because they don't care about data. They don't care about truth. They just want a sort of axe to grind or something like that. But this is how these Jewish intellectual movements work. They did not work because these people were so smart. They did not work because there was some kind of honest involvement in data and so on. They worked basically as authoritarian movements centered around the guru. And Freud is a great example. I mean, he was the sort of guru that was at the head of this movement, and he was worshipped by his followers. I mean, literally worshipped. Anyone who had contact with him or any kind of professional relationship with him was sort of Freud's aura would sort of rub off on him, and so it was all done by a sort of hierarchical authoritarian methods. Again, if you dissented, you were expelled. And again, it wasn't about Jewish IQ. It was really about Jewish ethnic networking. I mean, these people were smart, certainly, but it wasn't like their high IQ was really relevant to anything more than this verbal facility, because it was not really geared at finding out the truth. The psychoanalysis was really an attempt to sort of upend the moral structure of Western society, to cast the family as pathogenic, you know, that mothers were the root of all these problems. Sexual repression was at the root of everything. And so, you know, now as a result of this, I think we've had a big sea change. I mean, it's been very influential because it was taken up by the media, taken up by the educational system, became very respectable in the 1940s, 50s, and so on, into the 1960s. And
excuse me, and Professor, we're getting a little bit of background noise. I just want to warn you about that.
Okay. It had a huge effect on society. But, again, it was not based on truth or even trying to find the truth. It was based more on dogma and, you know, the sort of idolization of central figures, Freud in particular. But you could say the same thing about Boas. Boas was a different kind of guru for a different kind of group. It was, I would say, it was more empirically based, because they did studies, but they completely ignored biology, and so biological anthropology, which was very important in the last part of the 19th century and the early decades of the first of the 20th century, just was wiped away. I mean, by 1925, the departments of anthropology were completely under the control of Boas and students. I mean, he was very good at this. I mean, he had a lot of students. He was at Columbia. Again, the importance of being at a really good university where he could have some influence. And he spread his students out far and wide. A lot of them were Jewish. And they had a huge effect. And the main effect was to eradicate biology and Darwin from anthropology.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was saying, it's interesting. You said that they dominated their fields not because they were getting good results or getting at the truth, but, you know, just through their ethnic networking. Of course, they were effective in either promoting Jewish interests or subverting the interests of groups that they saw as rivals. Wouldn't you say that?
Well, I would say both were true.
Both are true.
Yeah,
and these are left-wing... I'm sorry.
In the early 20s, I think that the Jews got, you know, really at the top of American society, and it didn't really happen until after World War II. They were quite powerful, but they weren't a dominant ethnic group by any means. And the Jews, for example, were kept out of Harvard and so on. So that you had this basically Protestant, Anglo... group that was dominant in America, and it was this group that was basically displaced by these rising Jewish intellectual movements, beginning in the academic world, I would say, but also in the media. Jews started buying up the media. Even in the 1930s, Jews had a vastly disproportionate share of the media, and that made a big difference. I mean, you look at CBS at the time, NBC, very, very much under Jewish control. You look at all of Hollywood and so on, a lot of newspapers. So they were very influential group in the media. Their influence and their dominance wasn't as much as it came to be after World War II, but it was definitely there. And that's what really helped spread these movements. You know, especially psychoanalysis became very popular. But, you know, it also helped with anthropology. The idea of race became sort of taboo. Mm-hmm. You know, you had activists like Ashley Montague, who was at Princeton. Again, you notice these people are really top universities, and they use their positions in the academic world to further their ethnic interests. And Ashley Montague was a great example. He was instrumental in the UN Declaration on Racism, you know, where, basically proscribed or said that it was, you know, that there is no such thing as race, and that's the origins of that sort of thing. So, very influential, but also advancing Jewish interests. You look at the Frankfurt School, same thing, where they were advancing Jewish interests, pathologizing any sense of group identity among white America, among European Americans, any sense that they had any ethnic identity or any ethnic interest. That was seen as a pathology. But amazingly, they never questioned Jewish ethnocentrism there as a pathology. That was just fine. They went after Gentile, non-Jewish ethnocentrism. Mm-hmm. In America, they saw the roots of this in disturbed family relations. It was actually the other way around. In a way, it was funny because if you look at my chapter on that, chapter 5, they couldn't really lie completely. Quite a bit of their data was actually honestly obtained, but the way they spun it was just incredible. I mean, they would find these very healthy families that were not Jewish. They were, white American families. And they would just make up these psychoanalytic stories about how, even though they seemed very nice on the surface and everything was just fine on the surface, there were these deeply submerged conflicts, and this is what psychoanalysis allowed you to do. There was no observational basis, there was no scientific basis, no empirical basis. So they could just make up a bunch of stories. And then the stories they made up cast ethnocentric Americans in a bad light. On the other hand, when they found people who were not ethnocentric, they said, oh, these are really healthy families. Even though if you look at the actual data, these families were very conflicted. They're full of hostility, rejection, all these things. But they interpreted that as a sign of health, that these people were at least honest. It's just amazing. Just an amazing tour de force in how you can spin facts and data to suit your interests.
And you've talked about these left-wing movements in academia, and I can think of other social sciences, economics. So, for instance, you had the monetarism that was led by Milton Friedman. Or in political science, the realism, the school of realism, which is dominated by Hans Morgenthau, and these were more conservative movements, but maybe the contents of them weren't so specifically aimed at promoting Jewish interests, but the fact that you had kind of worship of Jewish founders. And you had this plethora of Jewish professors who were able to assign each other's reading. You wound up with this domination, Jewish hegemony in economics, in political science, and if nothing else, and I think there was other things to it, but if nothing else, having so many Jews leading economics and political science departments meant an economist was not going to be able to do any study of Jewish exploitation of Gentiles. Political scientist wasn't going to be able to look at this absolutely central number one issue of Jewish power in American politics. And so there are those implications, and you even see it outside of the social sciences. You look at biology and or archaeology, where biologists can't examine race. Archaeologists have been pressured to confine their studies to recent out of Africa origins. It's really been a giant stumbling block for real science, and certainly has tremendous implications. And I know you have studied neocon, the neoconservative political movement, as a as a Jewish-led intellectual movement. And, I'd like to ask you to comment on that. And also, perhaps even, how about this, Christian Zionism as a Jewish intellectual movement, or perhaps a Jewish anti-intellectual movement?
Yeah, because, my book, Culture for Critique, did not talk about neoconservatives, except there's like one or two lines. It was basically on the left, because Jews have fundamentally been on the left. But beginning, actually in the 1950s, you started to see some inkling that some of these Jews, especially followers of Trotsky, centered around Partisan Review and Commentary, the big Jewish publications, they started to become more sort of, quote, conservative. That is, they were, there was big involvement in the CIA, because the CIA was trying to find intellectuals who could combat communists. I mean, because the communism was a big deal then, and it was, there were an awful lot of intellectuals and university professors that were taken with communism, and so these people were actually recruited to combat that. And then you, one of their big interests was the fact that the Jews started to be discriminated against in the Soviet Union. I mean, Jews were a dominant group in the Soviet Union for the first decades, and I mean, at least till after World War II. And even after that, quite a bit. But beginning after World War II in the 1950s, you started to see that Jews were being discriminated against and sort of thrown out of some of their very dominant positions from the Bolshoi Ballet, the theater groups, universities, literary institutes, and so on. You know, again, Jews gravitate to these elite positions, and you basically had a purging of Jews from these positions. And pretty soon, Jews obviously were aware of this, and you started to have movements for Jews who were protesting the Soviet Union and wanted to actually leave the Soviet Union. And so these neoconservatives took up that cause in the 1960s, and certainly by the 1970s. Also, they were concerned about Israel. In America, you have two parties, they were very strong. The Jews always had a very strong foot in the Democratic Party. They didn't have very strong roots in the Republican Party. And during the 1970s, Jimmy Carter really disappointed the Jews. That they felt he was not pro-Israel enough. They felt he was too soft on foreign policy and so on. There was a big meeting at the White House, and they stomped out. They really rejected Jimmy Carter. So they started to sort of infiltrate the Republican Party as another source of power. Again, what they basically wanted was a very, very aggressive foreign policy centered around defending Israel. And by that time, they saw Russia as the enemy, and the Soviet Union as an enemy, because they felt that the Soviet Union was persecuting Jews. So that was the basic origins of that group. And but once they were in the Republican Party, they pursued those exact foreign policy interests. They became a very important aspect of that. I mean, there was non-Jewish politicians like Henry Jackson, the senator from Washington.
Scoop Jackson.
He was very instrumental in furthering the interests of the neocons. Actually, he was a Democrat, but then there were other senators, and within the not very long, they were the foreign policy establishment. I think by 19.
We're talking about, say, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, I believe Douglas Feith. They were all from Senator Jackson's office.
That's right. Senator Jackson was a huge facilitator of this, and he was famously anti-communist, and he saw these guys as a real weapon against communism.
And they president saw twice in the 1970s.
Person who could have been president of the United States, maybe, except he was not a very good speaker and had no charisma.
Yeah, but he ran twice. He ran in 72 and 76, yeah. and did reasonably well. Okay.
By the 1980s, they had arrived within the Reagan administration. They were instrumental in purging all these older conservatives from positions in the Reagan administration, and calling them racists, and people who had a long and very, very important history within American conservatism were being bumped out by these newcomers, who were basically centered around these Jewish these Jewish leaders and Jewish publications and Jewish think tanks. And
great.
The Reagan administration, they were the establishment in their party as far as foreign policy goes.
Okay, we have one more break this hour, and we're going to come back, and we will start taking callers at 1-800-313-9433. And welcome back to the Alternative Media. I'm Patrick Sletter. I'm here with Professor Kevin McDonald. Professor, will you be able to stay on into the second hour?
Yes, for sure.
Oh, great. Okay. And
we do have.
Excuse me?
It's gone fast, I must say.
Oh, yeah. It goes real fast. And we do have a caller from Montana. This is the name. I lost it on my screen. Caller from Montana, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you. Thank you very much. I am.
What was your name? I'm sorry, I missed it.
My name is David in Montana.
Oh, David. So what's on your mind, David?
I heard a story in the media about 3 weeks ago, which didn't make sense to me. And so I thought I would ask Kevin if it makes sense to him or how he would explain it. You probably heard the same story. The story was that Benjamin Netanyahu was speaking out against Donald Trump, telling Americans that they should not vote for him. And the reason that he gave is that because Donald Trump had made a statement that he wanted to have a moratorium on immigration to the United States of Muslims. And Benjamin Netanyahu said that because of this attitude, this racist attitude on the part of Donald Trump, Americans should not vote for him or have anything to do with this racist Donald Trump who wants to discourage Muslim immigration. I found it was a very strange statement. I don't really understand how a person like Netanyahu could be. Is he now a spokesman for Muslims? I don't understand. Yeah.
That's a great question, Dave. Thanks for your question. So, Professor McDonald, what about Benjamin Netanyahu as a spokesman for multiculturalism?
Wasn't that the most amazing statement? I did refer to discuss a little bit in one of my articles a while ago. It is just incredible chutzpah that he would say that. I mean, as if Israel would ever welcome Muslim immigrants. I mean, they do not. And you know, he's saying, well, we have these Muslims. Yeah, you have them, but you around 48% of Israelis want to expel them. And they certainly aren't going to take any more. The only people that can immigrate to Israel are Jews. So, in fact, Israel bans Muslim immigration. Of course they do. I mean, this is just incredible. But, you know, what you'll see is if there is a nationalist government in Europe or Trump gets elected or something like that, the government of Israel will go absolutely nuts. It's the same way they did when Haider became important politician in Austria. They just went crazy. I mean, you know, he's a racist and all that. And they, you know, this is an apartheid state that only admits Jews for immigration and so on. This is just absolutely absurd. But I think people are catching on. This is just, you know, just nonsense. And people are waking up to. I mean, it's so silly that a third grader can see through this, and yet we have people. You know, you have someone like Netanyahu saying this, and you don't see any criticism of that. And they people talking about the irony in the New York Times or the Washington Post or Fox News or anything. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. They get away with it.
Okay. Well, and we are at the end of hour one. We will be back after the top of the hour with Professor Kevin McDonald. I'm Patrick Slattery, and this is the Alternative Media.